Hi, this is Rich Coase, and I just wanted you to know that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. It could have been in Berwyn, but it isn't. Well, hello there. I'm Sven Gulli from MeTV, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. If there's an Indian in Annapolis, it means that he's like, you know, a military-type person from Native America. Could you turn up the volume, please? You're not going to hear me if you don't know. Hello there. I'm Sven Gulli from MeTV, and you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. FYI? FYI? And also, never mind. Hello there. This is Kerwin, the prehistoric rubber chicken from the Sven Gulli show on MeTV, and I wanted to remind you that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis, which is like Indian no place. Well, hello there. My name is Zalman T. Tombstone from the Sven Gulli program on MeTV, and I wanted to advise you that you're listening to Film Sociology on WFYI Indianapolis. I flunked sociology, so good luck.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
How's that for an epic opening? Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And it's also that time of year, folks. 1-800-233-0020 or go to WFYI.org/give if you want to support Film Sociology and all the programs you hear, all the local programs that you hear here at WFYI and WFYI.org if you're outside the Indianapolis area, Central Indiana, Southern Indiana. Anyway, 1-800-233-0020 or WFYI.org/give. Different opening. It's not Elmore Leonard, but that's, of course, Rich Coase and some of his famous characters like Tombstone, Sven Gulli, of course, and Kerwin. This week marks the 8th anniversary that Sven Gulli has now been on Saturday nights on MeTV. Here's your dilemma, folks. Sven Gulli airs Saturday nights at 8 o'clock on MeTV. Now, I would say you could probably put on Sven Gulli and then listen to the Blues House Party. Good luck with that. So anyway, I'm going to replay my epic chat with Rich Coase, who was very, very fun and somebody that I enjoy a great deal. And it's a great excuse to replay this clip. And then we're going to pay a tribute to the ghoul who passed away earlier this week. And so we might be a little horror show host heavy, and that's really okay. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, and it's been 2 weeks since I watched this. One of the big titles opening, no, not the remake of Pet Sematary. I remember seeing the original in college. Hope Fred Gwynn's ankles are okay. But Shazam is finally out in theaters, and it's the I remember seeing the trailer for this and hearing that they were going to make this, you know, a while back, and I had the same request. I had a similar request to when I first saw the trailers for the Melissa McCarthy movie. Can You Ever Forgive Me? And it was, obviously, we all know, DC needs a light film. And Wonder Woman wasn't quite it, although it's a really good film. Aquaman while is lighter than, as long as anything's lighter than Justice League and Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel, all that, that's fine, but still not light enough. This is about as frothy as it gets with Shazam, and that's what it does. And it comes out after Captain Marvel. And if you go online, because I don't have time to explain it. Well, I have time, but it's a podcast, but look it up. They will explain it better than me when it comes to licensing and all that, the difference between Captain Marvel and Shazam. But it's a story of an orphan, Billy Batson, played by Asher Angel, who gets into a foster home, including palling up with his buddy Freddy, played by Jack Dylan Grazer. For you fans of It, he's in that. And Billy becomes selected by an aging wizard, played by Jimon Hunsu, with a wig that looks like my hair. And he becomes selected to become, all he has to do is say the wizard's name, Shazam, and he becomes this muscular superhero. Not Captain Marvel, because that's the other movie. He does not turn into Brie Larson, I assure you. Mark Strong is in this, of course, is Dr. Thaddeus Savannah, who is the villain of the film, who audition, it's theater, was turned down to become the next inheritor of the powers of the wizard Shazam, and of course dedicates his life to raising havoc. First, to get to a couple negatives out of the way, the film is 2 hours and 10 minutes, so it's too long. Although not as long as Aquaman, and that film was too long. And you have two heavy hitters with Mark Strong and Jimon Hunsu, and they don't have a lot to do. Even with Mark Strong being the villain, both were hired to kind of do what they do best. Jimon Hunsu gets to, he gets to bellow and wear a fright wig and be intense. And Mark Strong gets to be quiet and reserved and then have his moments of emotional blast, but they're not really challenging roles. They do these all the time. You know, if you see, I'll put it this way, with the Mark Strong performance, if you've seen the car commercial with him and Ben Kingsley and the other British actors, you get the idea. But Zachary Levy plays Shazam, and of course the hero in adult form. And I had not seen Chuck, and then I have to give kudos to my daughter Emma for pointing out. He's the doctor in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So didn't know anything prior to him about his work there. But the film is a superhero version of Big. If you've seen the trailers, it plays up the comedy that here's this kid. He's got a new body. He needs to know what kind of powers he has. And his friend, who's really in the comic books and soon to be his orphan sibling, is going to help him out. So, you know, thwarting liquor store, convenience store robbers, and then trying beer and it's not good. Going into a strip club when he's old because he's in adult form, grown up form, and just trying to figure out what he can use, and also hopefully to use it to his advantage a little bit at school. So it's got that lightweight feel, and it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch Zachary Levy with this wide-eyed wonderment of his new situation in this muscular body. And I know some people have complained about the shift in tone, and the last third of the film, it gets too fighty. You know, you get the obligatory long, drawn-out battle. And it's set at Christmas time, and I can't remember if I'd read that it was supposed to come out at Christmas time, and then they delayed it. I wondered if it would, and also the fact that Aquaman was coming out, it was coming too fast on the heels of Aquaman. I don't know. I don't work at Warner Brothers. But so the fight scenes get a little dragged out near the end. But I didn't that shift of balance, because we're still dealing with a DC superhero film and this lightweight material of him figuring out what to do, where his powers come into play. That didn't bother me as much as others. It's not a perfect film, but as I said, DC needed a lightweight movie, and this is it. And that's all I kind of asked for. So, yeah, it's worth checking out. And I liked Captain Marvel. It's also not a perfect film, but it's completely different in tone. So, but yeah, these two can survive in the same, I guess, like both comics, they can survive in the same universe. Also noted, Jimon Hunsu is the first actor, I believe, to be in both a Marvel and a DC film, and he was also in Captain Marvel. So, there you go. New on DVD and Blu-ray. Well, you have The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot with Sam Elliott. For title alone worth checking out. You have Bumblebee, which, so long as it's shorter and not as serious as Transformers. I sat and watched the latest from Clint Eastwood, producing, directing, and starring in it called The Mule, about a 90-year-old horticulturalist who becomes a mule for a Mexican drug cartel. Pete Davidson started the joke, started the campaign, just ripping on the film. Directors can be self-indulgent when you direct and star. I have inserted myself in a couple plays that I have directed. I understand. The thing Pete Davidson made fun of most is that this is a 90-year-old man and he has his character, 90-year-old character, I should say, his character gets two threesome scenes in this film, one in a motel and the other at the house of Andy Garcia, who is the drug cartel he is working for. Being so obsessed with flowers and not being so reticent and paying attention much to his family, Diane Weiss plays his ex-wife. Allison Eastwood plays his estranged daughter. It's good to see Allison on screen with her dad again after the first time with Tightrope and then Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. But Eastwood, because of his character's lackadaisical, loves to be on the road. Winds up using the money. One of the supplements on the DVD talks about him being a modern day Robin Hood because he takes the drug money and helps do things like pay for a wedding, restore a VFW that was burnt down, things like that. Meanwhile, the other story that comes with it is Bradley Cooper is a DEA agent along with Michael Pena and Lawrence Fishburne who are out to get the cartel. And eventually it comes to a meeting of a diner scene almost out of Heat, but it was actually a Waffle House between Eastwood and Bradley Cooper. And yes, Mr. Eastwood is directed Mr. Cooper. It's amusing. But now this is the kind of role ever since, especially from Gran Torino on. And we thought Eastwood was going to retire from acting in Gran Torino, but he is not. He's done stuff like Trouble with the Curve and this. And it's the grumpy old man, doesn't understand the internet, not PC, doesn't have a filter. But not a tough guy. So there is that. I mean, he's not punching anybody out. He's not shooting anybody in this. So there's a little bit of change compared to his, as I said, Gran Torino, he kind of retired his tough guy image. So we don't think there's any guns or fist happening from here on out. But it feels like it was shot by an older person who's maybe not exactly with the times, and you're speaking to a man who is definitely not with the times. So he's done worse films. It's just, you have a lot of talent. You have a very talented cast, and there's a couple tense moments, but that's really about it. So I kind of wish he had made this film 15 or 20 years ago, but that's just me. Anyway, that's out on DVD and Blu-ray. Okay, over at IU Cinema, if you're listening to this first thing, Sunday at 1 o'clock, the film Future from 2018, and at 4 o'clock, Munyar Nagabo, sorry, at 4 o'clock, Monday, April 8th, Mantagi Maya, M-I-A, at 7 o'clock, Thursday, April 11th, The Good Girls at 7 o'clock, The Headless Woman at 10 p.m. And then Sunday, April 14th at 1 o'clock, Tulane Blacktop. That is happening at IU Cinema. At the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, we are in the midst of the Alfred Hitchcock Film Festival. On April 5th at 7:30 p.m., The Man Who Knew Too Much. And at 10 p.m. on April 5th, Marnie. On April 6th at 2 p.m., Shadow of a Doubt. At 5 p.m., Strangers on a Train. At 7:30 p.m., Rear Window. And at 10 p.m., The Trouble with Harry. That's happening at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin. Now it's the time of the show where you, well, mark your calendars. First off, Saturday, April 13th at the Richmond Art Museum in Richmond, Indiana. It is the 12th annual Fantascope Film Festival. I'm reading from a postcard. Saturday, April 13th, the annual Fantascope of High School Film Festival features short films made by student filmmakers from across the U.S. and Canada. Richmond Art Museum's jury competition with prizes for screenplay, acting, and more features a $1,000 cash prize for the best film. And along with this, you have a Q&A with Richmond High School alum and noted cinematographer Larry Blandford at 7 p.m. And the film screening starts at 7:30 and awards follow. To save you a trip from IMDb or entice you to go to IMDb, Larry Blandford from Richmond is known for such work as he was a director of photography on X-Men Apocalypse, Iron Man 3, Terminator Genesis, X-Men Days of Future Past, Mission Impossible Ghost Patrol, The A-Team, Night at the Museum, Smoke and Aces, Yours, Mine, and Ours, Fantastic Four, the 2005 version, Paycheck, Tears of the Sun, Madison, Minority Report, The Jackal, Far Away Home, The Rock, Broken Arrow, and many others. And was on a cinematographer on films like Ride Along, Fantastic Four, Ride of the Silver Surfer, and others. So anyway, that is happening over at the Richmond Art Museum on Saturday, April 13th. Keystone Arts, Landmark Keystone Arts Cinema, has announced their midnight movie series, June 7th and 8th, Mandy. June 14th and 15th, The Goonies. June 21st and 22nd, Perfect Blue. June 28th and 29th, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. July 5th and 6th, The Dark Crystal. July 12th and 13th, The Room. July 19th and 20th, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. July 26th and 27th, The Shining. August 2nd and 3rd, Princess Mononoke. August 9th and 10th, the original theatrical version of Donnie Darko. August 16th and 17th, Eraserhead, and August 23rd and 24th, Pulp Fiction. And Newfields has announced their Summer Night Series lineup. June 7th, Say Anything. June 14th, Sabrina. June 15th, Hairspray, the 1988 John Waters version. By the way, the Sabrina, the original version, 54. June 21st, The Producers, the original. June 28th, Suspicion. June 29th, Independence Day. July 5th, Ghost. July 13th through the 20th, yes, the Harry Potter film series. July 26th, the Indie Shorts International Film Festival Collection. August 2nd, To Have and Have Not. August 9th, Bring It On. August 16th, Moana. August 17th, the original Thomas Crown Affair, and apparently this is a members-only screening. August 23rd, 13 Assassins, and August 30th, the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. All of those happening at Newfields. There's a couple other videos I want to mention that I've been catching up with. There's a film called Unbridled, and it's a story of a young girl who's been sexually abused by her father, sent out for prostitution, forced by her father into prostitution. And finally, the father is arrested, and while he's in jail, she goes into recovery by working on a horse farm. So as she's spending time with the horse, she talks to the horse, and the horse listens. So it's the horse listener, but it's her getting her life back in order. The mother, who was forced to drink early and turn a blind eye, also is trying to get her life in line. The only actor of note, Eric Roberts, plays the dad. So there's that. And he shows up at the beginning, and of course you know he's going to show up near the end. The film has a kind of below Lifetime level when it comes to production value and acting-wise. If you love horses, you'll love this. And it has that kind of, it's a faith film-based feel to it. It's appeared at a couple of festivals, as says on the back of the box. But there is a moment where the horse becomes a hero in a way that, well, it's kind of like when I kind of rolled my eyes when in War Horse, the film, when you can see the horse running through the foxholes and jumping. It turned into kind of a video game there. In this one, the horse sacrifices itself, and like Dolph Lundgren at the end of the first Expendables, is still with us. So there, I have connected a faith film along with the Expendables. So yeah, it's there. And then we have the film Iceman, not the Timothy Hutton film from the 80s, but it is a story. They try to press it like it's a true story. Well, based on an event that in 1991, over 5,000-year-old frozen body was found, and this film tells its story of a village who is attacked and killed, and we have the only survivors are a newborn baby and one of the elders of this village, and now he's got to travel, raise the child, and extract revenge on those who killed his family. Now, like Quest for Fire, even less than Quest for Fire, there's no dialogue because it's over 5,000 years ago, but at least there is no Clan of the K-Bear created language. A lot of walking and raising the baby. Franco Nero has a cameo in this. You have to pay attention to this. And gorgeous scenery. But it is obviously a less is more, more physical, challenging film to watch. It probably could have been 20 minutes shorter for my taste because we're not burdened with dialogue. But it's a workout. It is a cinematic workout. Anyway, those are also new on video. Okay, we are going to shift gears. We're going to get into the horror show host portion of the program. Svengoolie is celebrating its 8th year of being on Saturday nights on MeTV, and you can check out Svengoolie Saturday nights at 8 o'clock when you're not listening to the Blues House Party, or you could watch him on mute and listen to the house party. Anyway, whatever. So Saturday nights at 8 on MeTV, here is my epic chat with Rich Coase. Enjoy. You grew up in Chicago, right?
Yeah, I've pretty much spent my whole life here in Chicago, my whole life and even my whole career. I was born in Chicago, and about 4 years after that, we moved to some suburbs of Chicago.
Such as?
Around the Morton Grove Niles area.
As a kid, what horror show host did you watch?
I barely got in on one of the originals. I was very young, but I remember seeing at some relatives' houses when we were there late, Marvin, Terry Bennett, who hosted Chicago's Shock Theater. Now back then, of course, that was the name. Shock was the name of the Universal movie package that was released all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Vampyra was first running her stuff out in L.A. And in Chicago, it happened to go to WBKB-TV, where Terry Bennett worked, and he became Marvin, the sort of beatnik-type ghoul host.
That lay the foundation for Jerry G. Bishop?
Not so much, because I think Jerry was already out of town by then and working his way through radio in various cities, radio and TV.
How old were you when you started watching Jerry?
I was actually just about to enter college.
And what were your impressions of watching Jerry work on television?
Well, first of all, I'd been a fan of his anyway from his radio work. He'd been on the air doing morning radio and such for many years already before he even hit that. And I was a fan of his, so I, you know, was tuning in just because I heard that he was doing some funny shtick in between things as just a voiceover announcer for the horror movies on Friday night. And as it was developing along, you know, I enjoyed the character that he was portraying as well and how he was kind of, you know, positioning himself between the various segments of the movie.
Did he ever tell you how he developed the character?
He kind of was taking a tip from the famous Ernie Anderson, Goulardi, who was on opposite him on TV when he was working in Cleveland. But Goulardi was another sort of beatnik-type character. And Jerry decided to kind of update that and make it a sort of hippie ghoul. And so he kind of got the nod from that. And then he always said that his Svengoolie accent was kind of Bela Lugosi crossed with Yiddish.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, what was even funnier was he always described my accent as a combination of Bela Lugosi and Lawrence Welk.
So Berwyn really loves you.
I guess so, yeah. Much closer ties than I thought.
Well, it's interesting because looking back, because I asked the question I had earlier about the Foundation for Jerry is because of the hippie persona, and then you mentioned the beatnik persona, it was interesting as a youngster with my local horror show host. I grew up in Michigan, and ours was Sir Graves Ghastly out of Detroit. Mm-hmm. Is on the surface, it was scary looking, but then I realized, looking back, he did a segment in drag. He did a segment German. He would paint a face on his chin and be filmed upside down. And he showed kids pictures. And in your case, looking at the early pictures, by the way, there's somebody here at work who grew up in Elkhart, and she wanted me to tell you, you scared her when she was a little kid.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few people.
You're right
there.
but the fact is, maybe the exterior was scary, but you know, you're cracking jokes the entire time. And I thought, especially with Jerry's, it's a hippie. He's not a vampire or a ghoul or a zombie. It's a hippie that delivers one-liners.
Right, exactly. I think part of it is just that the characters. I always said, there have always been people who said you should try to act more scary. And I've often said, well, the only people who will be scared by that are, kids under the age of 5. It's not very effective. If you're trying to act scary and, people are watching, they're going to go, oh, come on. Whereas making the character kind of comic relief to the horror is what seems to be what works. And for the most part, that's what most of the very successful hosts have done, whether it be tongue-in-cheek or, just blatant, goofballs like myself.
What did you think the first time you saw Count Floyd on SCTV?
I thought he was hilarious. It was funny because I had actually seen Joe Flaherty, who played Count Floyd, live at Second City while he was in his tenure here in Chicago. It was right after I got out of high school, in fact. And I thought he was a very funny guy to begin with. But then when I saw that, I thought it was really hilarious. And one of the things that somebody brought up is, he obviously was still doing Second City here in town. He hadn't gone back up to Canada during the time that Jerry was doing his Svengoolie stuff here. So it seems like, a little bit of that might have been, added into his whole Count Floyd persona. The idea of, running movies that maybe weren't quite, what you would want to run during the time. Because Jerry had a few that were like, wait a minute, this isn't really a horror movie. And yeah, I thought Count Floyd was very, very funny.
Now, I know you started sending jokes to Jerry. What do you remember the first one he ever used?
I think it was something like, you'll love this one.
Okay.
What do you call a grave in Russia?
A what?
A communist plot.
Oh. You know what? I think that's being used on Fox News today, so it's all right.
Well, yes, it's right up their alley there. Yeah, so at first I was just sending him random jokes that I thought he could use because he was, actually soliciting them from viewers. And then I let him know a little bit about what I was doing, that I was a broadcasting student. And I actually wrote something that was more specific for him. And he started to kind of request specific things, like, can you do a parody of such and such commercial or something like that. So it got into more long-form things than just separate jokes.
And how long before he invited you into the studio to work?
I would say it was, at the most, about a year, probably a little less than that. And he had me come in, and I ended up going in there, and he'd say, hey, can you do this voice for me off camera? And, I did some artwork that he needed for the show. One of the guys working there then would jokingly refer to me as Jerry's art director. And he had me going with him and doing his public appearances with him, his various characters and such. And, and then it became pretty much he was trying to work it out so that I would have a full-time job at Channel 32. But before that happened, his Svengoolie show was canceled. So,
well, before the birth of Son, what did your parents hope you would be doing at this time?
I don't know that they had any specific direction that they were hoping I would go in. My dad worked in sheet metal and ventilation, and I think he pretty much knew that I wasn't planning to go in that direction. They knew that I liked radio, and I think they kind of thought that I would go in that direction in broadcasting, but I don't know that they expected me to go into television as well.
Well, how did Son of Svengoolie come about?
Basically, what happened was there was a time in between when I became son of Svengoolie and when Jerry stopped being Svengoolie, that one of the guys that was a friend of Jerry's at one of the local stations had called him and said, you know, you should just do Svengoolie just as a summer fill-in thing for us here. And they talked about it a little bit, and Jerry was like, well, I don't know that I want to dress up in this stuff again. And he said, you know what? He said to me, why don't you could be like son of Svengoolie, and then you and I can write and, you know, produce the thing together. And I was like, sure, that'd be cool. And then we talked about it, kicked it around, had some false starts on it, and nothing ever really happened with it. And then a couple of years down the road, when Jerry was going to head out to San Diego to do radio and TV there, he said, well, you know, what are you planning on doing now? Because somebody else I had been working with, Dick Orkin, do you know him?
I've heard the name.
Famous radio guy who did radio commercials and did a lot of famous modern radio serials like Chicken Man.
Oh, right.
And Tooth Fairy.
Yeah.
I'd been working with him, and he went off to L.A., and now Jerry was leaving, and he said, well, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to pitch some local station on a TV show and see if I can make any inroads there. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, you have my blessing. And so he kind of handed that off to me, and which was very flattering that he would, you know, take the character that he had created and kind of, you know, turned it over to me more or less.
Now, for those who don't go on YouTube, what was the, besides the look, what was the biggest difference between Jerry's character and yours?
Let's see. Well, Jerry used to play the guitar and sing, and I cannot play the guitar well enough to do that.
We thank you for that.
Yes, yeah, anytime. Believe me, you wouldn't want to sit through that. But basically, it's the same type of character, you know, kind of wisecracking. And I think Jerry's character, I don't know how to put this better, was a little more aggressive than mine. And I think that, you know, Sven is more, the one that I'm doing is more the Jack Benny character who is set upon by the other characters and such around him. Whereas Jerry was more, you know, the wise guy who was, you know, dealing with the others or something.
And, yeah, so you're the chicken butt of the jokes.
Yes, exactly. Well put.
Thank you. And when did the was the chickens your creation, the flying chickens?
Oh, no, that went back to Jerry.
Okay.
The famous old vaudeville prop of a rubber chicken.
Right.
He decided that whenever he would do some bad joke, which was pretty often, he would be pelted with those rather than tomatoes or something like that, or bricks, which would not have been pleasant.
Or the giant hook.
The giant hook, yes. That would have been much more difficult to have one of the stagehands maneuvering all the time. You got to also spread the fun to people, because if there's one thing people always request is, can I come and throw chickens at you?
Gee, I don't know what you're talking about. I think I'm at the bottom of the scroll right now.
I see.
My first viewing of you, of course, was syndicated on Channel 50 in Detroit, and this was in the early 80s. How did the syndication come about?
Well, after there had been various shows that had run back and forth, they had tried to run The Ghoul from one of the stations that was owned by, which company was it at the time? Kaiser, I guess, Kaiser Broadcasting. And they actually bumped Jerry Svengoolie off so that they could run The Ghoul. And he was not well accepted in Chicago because compared to Jerry's character, this was, you know, an interloper. And he didn't make any friends because we first started out saying, I'm like, yeah, we got rid of that bum Svengoolie. Nice work.
Nice.
But based on that and the fact that there was a guy in power at our Chicago station who was running all the field stations, they were field stations by then.
Right.
He really believed in what I was doing, and he wanted to get it on the other channels. And the funny thing was that we ended up on five different channels in different cities, but a lot of the stations, for some reason, felt that this was being forced on them, so they would not promote it, and you know, they would do nothing to help us out. And now, years later, I hear from people who watched me in the various cities, and they were like, oh, yeah, everybody used to watch that. And I had no idea that there was an audience watching me back then. And they say, oh, you went to Chicago after this. And I said, no, actually, I was in Chicago the whole time. And we would customize the opens and closes, especially, so that it would look like, you know, it was something, you know, with jokes playing off that specific city. It was kind of a pain because we'd have to reshoot every open and every close for each city, and I'd have to rewrite it so that I would get in local jokes.
What were the other cities?
We were in San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago.
I remember because you made a crack on Bill Kennedy, who hosted the local show, the
right,
local movie
sure.
show in the afternoon. And I remember calling Channel 50 and asking about you, and they told me that you were based out of Chicago, and I didn't believe them.
No.
Because you mentioned Bill Kennedy. How did, you know, of course you know. So,
yeah. Well, it was funny because when we were going to do it, I asked each one of the stations, can you just send me a bunch of, like, a weatherman that I can make fun of, you know, various locations in the city, sports teams. And out of the stations, a couple of them sent really detailed stuff, and the rest were like, yeah, never mind.
Okay, I have to ask, how was Detroit's treatment of you?
Detroit was fairly weak. Sorry. They sent, like, just a little bit of information and a Detroit Pistons basketball jersey.
You still have it?
I believe I gave it to one of my brothers after the show was over.
How long did this last, the syndication?
It varied in the cities from, like, about 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And a lot of that was because they just, you know, they didn't promote it, and they felt like it was not, you know, it was not something they wanted to do. It wasn't their production. At one point, we actually went to Philadelphia and shot on their set. They built a whole set just for me to shoot on.
Wow.
And everybody there, for the most part, was not cooperative. You know, we were doing different bits and stuff. We ran a bit that was pretty famous that we did, Mr. Robber's Neighborhood.
Right.
Where, you know, I'm supposed to be like a Fred Rogers as a criminal who breaks into people's homes. That's why he changes his shoes so they can't hear him.
Right.
And he was talking about how he had a good sharp knife to do something with. And one of the engineers there goes, oh, that's nice, teaching kids to use knives.
Wow, this coming from Philly fans that cheer when Santa Claus get taken off on a stretcher at Eagles games.
Well, what can I tell you? So it was an uphill battle in most of those places, and I think that's why it didn't last, especially in a couple of those cities.
Well, from a kid's standpoint, it felt like it was on longer, and I mean that as a compliment. And I think also because of the test of time, and there's no internet, and it was you had to be there for that time, unless you had a VHS or Betamax. You had to be there for that time to see the show.
Exactly. Yeah, that was it. You know, that's why I hear these people now who see the old clips and go, wait, I remember when this was on in you know, San Francisco or whatever.
Yep.
It's quite as weird. I think San Francisco was the city that we were in the longest, and that was like a full year. By then, all the others had dropped out.
Some of the other characters that you had now, was Durwood from the Jerry era, or was and you inherited him?
Yes, Durwood, the ventriloquist puppet, was from Jerry's era, and to this day, I wish he hadn't picked such a high falsetto voice, which he could do much better than I could, because I felt he should still have a similar type voice. You know, I didn't want to change the voice on it, but it's much harder for me to do. Tombstone was a character based on, really, he had a female skull named Zelda. And, again, I didn't want to do the exact same thing with that, so we created Tombstone. His name originally was Zalman T. Tombstone, Jr., and it was a playoff on the old Billy Saluga character, Raymond J. Johnson,
oh,
Jr., that was very popular
right.
at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Tombstone even had his own little litany, you know, like the, he doesn't have to call me Johnson type thing, you know. But you can call me Toomey, or you could call me, and we did that at a while beginning. After all, I was like, I think people will be sick of this. Let's just drop it.
I always imagined Tombstone, it sounded like if Bob Dylan and the Kingfish had a child.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Oh, okay.
Definitely.
Tell us about the evolution of Kerwin.
Kerwin, yeah. Well, we've had a series of different sort of puppet-like assistants doing the mail. The first was our piano player, Doug.
Right.
And he was actually a live person. But he often couldn't stay around long enough because he's in actuality a working musician who constantly has different gigs all over the place. So he couldn't wait around until we got, you know, after we did the song to do the music. We did the music bits, and then we'd have to wait to do the mail after we did several other things, and he often couldn't stay around. So we said, well, let's try some things. And we had a bat whose voice was like a sort of processed high tone thing.
Right.
And it was so annoying that one of the bosses in charge here actually said, I want you to get rid of it. And we had to actually do a bit where he was fired because he couldn't stand that voice. And then for a while we had a pterodactyl who was a disc jockey who was the assistant, and a dinosaur, I believe. We're very into reptiles at times.
I see.
And finally, we had a spider for a while. And because he had eight legs, he had eight different voices. And for some reason, that just didn't work at all. But finally, someone from our kids' show, Green Screen Adventures, a young lady named Jessica Hope Carlton, who is very adept at building puppets, kind of as a surprise, cooperating with my director, came up with this. She used like one of those sort of alligator type things you buy at the zoo. It's like a head on a stick, and you pull the little trigger to make it talk and move the mouth. And she combined that with the body of a rubber chicken and created Kerwin as a prehistoric rubber chicken.
Who sounds like Jerry Lewis?
Who, yeah, well, when I first looked at him, when they gave him to me, he had these kind of goofy eyes and funny teeth, and for some reason it struck me that he sort of looked like very young Jerry Lewis. So that was why he got the voice. It was kind of like this.
Do you also not bring up Dean Martin around him?
No, I constantly bring up Dean Martin just to make him angry.
So speaking of Doug, how do you select the music for the shows?
You know, I've often been asked by one of my coworkers, what are you thinking? Because I'll say, you know, I want to do something, you know, this is about like flying to the moon. And he'll say, okay, and he comes up with all these songs with moon in it. And then I'll go, I know, and come up with some song that has no word moon in it. And he'll be like, wait, I don't get it. But there's some way that I can tie in certain lyrics that sound exactly like, you know, what the originals are that has something to do with the movie.
And how did you meet Doug?
Doug and I went to high school together, actually. We were in band together in high school. And we became friends and just hung around together. And when I started doing TV shows, I figured, you know, it would be great to have him help out.
What did you play?
I played trombone. It's been a long time since I played trombone, so please don't ask me to do a solo.
Oh, no, that's right. Well, we live in the land of J.J. Johnson. We wouldn't ask you to do that.
Well, certainly, yeah.
But I also imagined you as Woody Allen in Take the Money and Run, where you played the cello, but you also had to drag the chair during the parade.
Let me tell you, being a trombone player in a parade is not fun because you're right at the front of the band, because of the slide action, they put you there, and also, when you're playing, you don't get to look down and see if there's anything dropped by the horses that were earlier in the parade. That was one of the biggest hazards. And I always thought that doing marching band out on a field was one of the most unmusical experiences ever, because you think you're doing these formations and stuff, and half the instruments turn away from the stands while they're walking in, you know, some pattern, and that means they can't hear that part of the music. So it's like you're not hearing the whole, you know, thing like you do in a concert. What's the deal?
How did Jerry and you come up with all of those sound clips?
Well, with Jerry, it was a matter of, you know, he used them in his radio stuff. Mm-hmm. And he had a huge library of sound effects and little sound bites and things that he passed a lot of on to me. And actually, it was the same thing with me because I wanted to be in radio, and I also did that. I mean, maybe it's not as common anymore, but a lot of disc jockeys used to use little, you know,
Sure. These
little sound bites, little, you know, cart type reactions and called, because they were on audio carts that you'd throw into the machine. And just built up this whole library. And of course, once I started here, a lot of the guys had suggestions for things or would find something in a show or in a commercial and say, oh, you know, you should really use this. So we've got it all. It's all now computerized, obviously, like everything else. It's all digital, and it's in a little machine that we can just call up a number and hit.
How many films or how many episodes do you record in one batch?
It varies. We've done as many as 9.
Wow.
Which is, you know, we're in the studio from noon until 9 o'clock every night when we do these.
Okay.
And that's a long haul. Believe me, being in that makeup for that length of time, not pleasant. But, yeah, we've done as many as 9, and a comfortable range is usually 5, I would say.
Okay.
Because that gives us a little, you know, easier time of it. And we're not, like, under the gun like, you know, Lucy in the Candy Factory.
And when you're selecting the films, is there a pattern? I mean, you know, sci-fi, horror, monster movie, killer movie. Is there a pattern of any kind?
Well, it's not so much a pattern. My idea usually is to try to vary it somewhat, because we do get people who will often complain about the fact that we're doing too many mummy movies all at once, or too many Frankenstein movies. And, you know, to me, it's like, you're complaining about these Universal classics? Okay, whatever. But I try to vary them when I can. And also, there are certain ones that we have only a certain time window for, so we have to make sure that they can air only during, like, we've had movies that we can only run during 1 month.
Jeez.
So we have to, you know, make sure it gets in then. So a lot of times it depends on what the contractual window is, the window of time that we can fit the movies in, and, you know, what's available to us at what times.
Right off the top of your head, what are some of your favorite and least favorite films that you've shown over the years?
No, favorite ones, definitely Bride of Frankenstein. I do like House of Frankenstein. I got to run Nightmare on Elm Street, which I really enjoyed, and
wow.
Halloween, the originals. I really enjoyed those. Ones that I don't like as well, there's quite a few of those. I think I may have mentioned to you before the Midnight Movie Massacre, which was an absolutely terrible movie. There was one movie that I often cannot remember, Track of the Vampire,
oh.
Which is so bad and boring. It's a movie where half of it was shot in California and the other half was shot in Yugoslavia, and neither side knew what the other side was doing. And it was so bad that when I was at Channel 32, we actually intercut it with a bunch of other things. And we did one whole segment that was kind of, you know, Svens around, where it had changed, and suddenly the woman, it's a scene where this woman is being chased all through the city and into the ocean by the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And with my redubbing, it became the fact that she was supposed to show up for swim team practice and didn't want to. And that was the coach running after her. And at times there was like a bald lifeguard who showed up. So naturally his voice became that of Curly Howard from the Three Stooges.
Of course.
So, yeah, that was one of the really, really awful ones.
I would say, is it the quality of the film that gets it a Svens around treatment, or have you? I think I remember once you did it with even with Night of the Living Dead.
We did separate scenes from that. A lot of times I'll lift scenes, and so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the movie, or, you know, ruin people's enjoyment of the actual movie itself. If it's a really bad movie, a lot of times the only way to save it is to do something like add some sound effects to it along the way.
Now, I know there was one of the writers from Mystery Science Theater 3000 grew up in Chicago. Have you made contact with any of those guys before?
No, I've never been in contact with them. I've heard from other people that, you know, they've done little shout-outs to Sven in some of their shows. That one guy said he went to some convention and dressed as me and ran into one of them, and the guy immediately said, "Hey, your son is Sven Gulli."
Okay.
They know about it. And I remember reading an article in the Chicago Tribune where they were talking to a couple of the guys, and they said, you know, we weren't the type of guys who were trying to, you know, pick up Cousin Brucey on the radio from New York or whatever like that. We were trying to watch people like Ray Rayner, who did a morning kids show here in Chicago, and Sven Gulli. So they were aware of both, and they obviously saw both Jerry Sven Gulli and my son of Sven Gulli.
Have you ever talked to any of the filmmakers or actors whose movies you've aired?
Very rarely. You know, a lot of them right now, a lot of these Universal folks,
a lot of them
not
are
around.
Dead.
although I did hear, I've got a couple guys who do a great website called Terror from Beyond the Daves. And they have a blog about different horror hosts and horror-oriented things. And they both are guys who grew up watching me and are big fans. And now, especially with our national exposure, when they go to conventions, they get a lot of feedback about the show from people. They ran into Julie Adams, who was the beautiful woman in the white bathing suit in Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
And she was just thrilled to hear that, you know, we show her movie on our program. The same thing with Tippi Hedren from The Birds.
Sure.
We ran at The Birds here in Chicago and won the time slot, which was just, you know, incredible. It's like Sven Gulli winning the time slot. Good grief. But she was another one who was just thrilled to hear that we were running that show on free broadcast TV, since it hasn't appeared on that very much. And it's just really great to, you know, get even these secondhand things. I did meet Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger. And it turns out he's a big fan of my show. He's been watching it out in California now. And he's had a lot of very complimentary things to say about it, which is really nice. I'm trying to think about Lance Henriksen.
Mm-hmm.
Met up with him. He's a very nice guy. It was a lot of fun and seemed to enjoy the show. We ran him in Pumpkinhead a couple
yes.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Piranha 2 as well. So
well, that's good.
Yes.
How often are you allowed in Berwyn?
I'm allowed there any darn time I want to be there.
Do you have the key to the city yet?
They don't even need a key. I've got like a key card. Just lets me in and out. It's not a problem. Actually, yeah, it's funny because just about, I'd say, 95% of the people in Berwyn love that we do the stuff that we do about that city. And they know it's just jokes. For a while, they had a mayor who was you know, we don't want to be the butt of Sven Gulli's jokes. And yet any time I'd show up there, he always made sure he was there to get a picture shaking my hand.
Politician.
Yes. And occasionally it's like the people who are like, oh, you know, you shouldn't make fun of our town. But the thing is, every time I've done a radio interview or TV interview and people have asked about Berwyn, I've always, you know, stated what I just told you and the fact that it's a really nice suburb. The people are very nice there. They're all hardworking people. And now they're trying to be, you know, a little more upscale and they're adding more arts and things. And, you know, God bless them. It's a nice place. And it also has my favorite horror collectibles store, a place called Horror Vault, which has a real nice stock of all sorts of things.
How did you pick Berwyn out of all the towns for the bit?
That was Jerry's doing. Back when he was trying to figure it out, he had always had, when he was in Cleveland, Goulardi, Ernie Anderson, made fun of a suburb called Parma. And when he came here, he had that in mind. And he also, at that time, Rona Martin's Laugh-In was kind of winding down.
Uh-huh.
And they were making fun of beautiful downtown Burbank, as was Johnny Carson. And he thought, well, we need to do something like that. We can make small town jokes about that. It'd be funny. And he was trying to decide on something. And he ended up having a sponsor that was from the Berwyn area. And when he went there, it seemed like the one street, Ogden Avenue, was all savings and loans and used car lots. And then he found out that they had the yearly parade in honor of mushrooms, the Hobie Parade. Hobie is Czech for mushroom.
Yeah.
And he decided this would be a good place to use as our city that we kind of poke fun at.
Well, it has a flow to it compared to, say, Downers Grove, Westmont, or Wheaton.
Yeah, you can't go like Cicero. It doesn't flow as well as Berwyn.
Is there a film that you've always wanted to show and have not had a chance to do yet?
Yes. Fiend Without a Face. Do you know that movie?
The French film, right?
No.
Oh,
no.
I'm thinking of Eyes Without a Face. I'm sorry.
No. This is like a cheapo. I think it's an America International one.
Okay.
Where there's something invisible that is killing people, and they're not sure what it is. And at some point, they find a way to make them visible, and it turns out there are these brains with spinal columns that kind of like inch along. They were done with stop-motion animation. And when they're fighting with them, when you shoot one, it makes a noise like a whoopee cushion kind of and lets loose the sort of raspberry jelly type stuff.
Is this the flying brains with the eyes? Or am I thinking of something else?
You may be confusing it with the brain from Planet Eros.
Ah, okay. All right.
But these, you would remember these right away because they're smaller brains, about the size of a human brain, but they have this sort of spinal column, and they inch along like an inchworm using that. And they can also, like, leap through the air.
Well, this is my YouTube project for the day. That's good.
All right. Yes, you'll enjoy it. Believe me.
Now, how long have you been with the U?
I have been here since 1995. At WCIU, and then as we've added more stations, my shows have gone on to the various stations, and including now our network, MeTV.
How did the MeTV deal come about?
Because of the great success we had here in town. When the U first went on, it was kind of a hybrid of what MeTV is, and you know, also a little more modern type programming that we would manage to get. And as we went along, my boss, Neil Saban, who was like a genius, had noticed that like Nick at Night and TV Land were changing dramatically, and they weren't what they originally were supposed to be, you know, with this classic TV stuff. And he had this idea of making the MeTV station, which we did first locally here, and he felt that there was viability to that across the country since, you know, people weren't really getting that presented the way that we presented. And he managed to start, you know, start the wheels in motion, and now we're in almost 80% of the country.
Cool.
And it's especially amazing that it happened in about a year's time. To have that kind of progress really says a lot for what Neil could do and what the MeTV national network can do.
I'd say you could call those other syndicated cities from the 80s and blow raspberries at them, but they're probably not there anymore or probably dead.
Oh, you never know. Yeah, most of the people involved have probably moved on and are not quite around anymore or, yeah, have been deposed. Knowing the nature of television, they probably lost their jobs.
And they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore.
Yes, and I'll shed a tear for them like that Indian standing alongside the highway.
For MeTV, is it strictly Universal Films?
Right now it is, yeah. We have a really nice contract with Universal, and we're actually working on an extension of that for the future that would add in even more films for us. And we're hoping that that'll happen. And this is really, you know, the first broadcast TV national exposure for these Universal horror films since many, many years ago.
Which I think is a really cool thing. I know recently there's been films like The Mole People, which I haven't seen in a long, long time. And I know the horror film with Dirk Benedict and Strother Martin. I mean, those are ones I can't even think of the last time I saw
those. You're talking about
But I think it's cool that you look for films that have not seen the light of day in a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's really an education for a lot of people because there is a generation that hasn't seen these. When we were kids, it seemed like they ran them much more on television. And now, if they run at all, they run on cable as opposed to on, you know, actual broadcast TV. So the fact that we're kind of, you know, reintroducing these to a lot of people who maybe never saw them before is really great. And it's nice to continue the Universal legacy.
And also, from an educational standpoint, I love when you do a segment based on who these actors appeared in, you know, what other films they've appeared in, what the director has worked on. You know, when my daughter saw that Bela Lugosi played the Frankenstein monster, that blew her lid a little bit, in a good way.
Sure, yeah. There are things that people really don't expect or, you know, they don't know about connections to various things, like the people who ended up playing some other part on a TV series years later, that they had no idea that ever happened. So it's very cool to be able to, you know, make these connections for people or just remind people, you know, this guy also did this. And at times it's really a tribute to the versatility of the actors, and it's great to show that they had a wide enough range to do so many things.
You're walking IMDb, sir.
Yeah. No, I'm sitting right now, actually.
And I know also you've also been showing comedy shows, and don't listen to the internet. There's nothing wrong with that, with showing, you know, I know you've done the Three Stooges Marathon and Abbott and Costello. And
yeah.
You know.
Well, most of the Abbott and Costello stuff we've shown still has a horror element to it. It's not, you know, we're not just showing, you know, Hit the Ice or something like that.
Right.
Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy or you know, Frankenstein or whoever. We've thrown in a few things here and there. Yeah, well, you know, Ghost and Mr. Chicken, there's still like a horror scare element to that. If anything, you know, we've run some Marx Brothers movies, and that's mainly because I'm a big fan of the Marx Brothers. They were a big influence on me. And, you know, I love when people are like, oh, this is wrong. You should be showing only scary things. And it's like, have you noticed that a great portion of my part of the show is comedy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And we also like that, you know, you air it the same reason why dogs lick their elbows, because you can.
There you go. Exactly.
And also,
thanks for saying elbows.
Well, yes. Thank you for saying elbows, too. And also, it's really cool that the show on MeTV, you kind of become an ambassador for local horror show hosts. It's a lost art. I mean, we have Sammy Terry popping up every few months here in Indianapolis, but it's cool for you to give shout outs to cities that have had hosts, and you show other hosts and even show old photos of Jerry and you. It's a lost art, I think, for local television.
Well, with the way that television has been going now in the TV economy, most local stations do not do entertainment-type shows. They're mainly, you know, if they have budgets, they're going to do news and sports and public affairs and an occasional magazine show. But, you know, they're not going to do something that's strictly entertainment because, according to them, it doesn't generate enough money to justify, you know, the studio time and editing time and everything like that. And when we first started here locally, the people in charge of the station said, you know, well, maybe we're not going to make money on this, but it's an important part of TV and something that viewers really get an attachment to and make a connection with, and that's important to us. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, we're doing very well, and it's nice to see that people, you know, every email I get from out of town, for the most part, will mention, we haven't had anything in town like this since, you know, in the 70s with, you know, Dr. Bad Teeth or something like that. So there's always, everybody's got a horror host they watch sometime in their life, it seems.
Do you do shows strictly for MeTV, and then you do shows strictly for the U?
We have some shows that run basically, well, the ones that run on MeTV right now also run on the U as like a week delay basis. But then on the U2, we run some of the older ones that we have that we still have rights to or that are public domain. And I also do a Three Stooges show, Stoogiepalooza, that runs on Saturday nights on our MeTV channel.
So I was going to say, how often do you get to appear on TV as Rich?
Every week.
Okay.
Basically,
there
yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's I'm in the makeup, I'm out of the makeup. In the makeup, out of the makeup.
Well, you know, it keeps you young, maybe.
Well, I don't know about that.
Or young at heart.
Okay, I'll go with that.
So what's next for Svengoolie?
Right now, it seems like we're just continuing to go to more and more of the places in America. More and more stations are picking up the MeTV network and getting better distribution of it. And a lot of them, we started out just over the air, and now it's going to cable as well in a lot of the cities, and wider distribution in a lot of the cities. There are a lot of rumors about out on the West Coast that we're going to have more visibility out there. So I think it's just a matter of the Sven Show catching on in these various places, and then I think the next step after that is possibly starting to make public appearances all over the country, which should be fun.
Well, you know, you have a place to crash in Indianapolis, that's for sure.
Well, thanks, I appreciate that.
That's Rich Coase, a.k.a. Svengoolie. Svengoolie can be seen Saturday nights at 8 o'clock on MeTV, celebrating 8 years of being on television on Saturday night. And the horror show host is a lost art. Thank goodness we have folks like Sammy Terry and, of course, Svengoolie. We do want to pay tribute to a gentleman who just passed away recently, Ron Swede, best known as the Ghoul from the 1970s, died earlier this week. Best known, it was started in Cleveland and then was syndicated in Detroit a little before my time. I believe he was on Detroit television from 72 to 75, and I'm sure some people will correct me on that. Channel 50 in my beloved home state. But anyway, he was one of those. It was goofy and fun, and there's a lot of clips on YouTube. There was also a brief period like Svengoolie where he was syndicated for a while. It was a little bit of back history. This was his kind of takeoff on Goulardi, if you are in a long-time horror show host and history. And so it was manic, and it broke some barriers. Maybe, I don't know about taboos, but it did break some barriers. But for a while, it was on Kaiser Broadcasting. This is where I discovered Svengoolie. They had stations, Kaiser Broadcasting had stations in Cleveland, Detroit, San Francisco, Boston, and a few others. And the Ghoul was syndicated for a while. So, but anyway, we found a little bit of audio clip thanks to YouTube for this. So here's a little sample, just a sample of the work of the Ghoul. Salute to you, sir.
Give me an O! Give me a U! Give me an L! My name is the Ghoul!
Yes, boys and girls, moms and dads, aunts, uncles, whatever, whoever you may be, listen up and listen up good. Welcome to the first annual Stupid Day here on the Ghoul Show. Ah! Now, you may well ask, say, hey, what is Stupid Day? Well, even every week when I stumble through the door, it gets pretty stupid. But today, oh, today is nothing, okay? Check this out. You want to know what's really stupid today on this show? How about a guy suspended from a rope in full evening dress playing an accordion? Let him rip. Oh, Teddy, is that not stupid? Oh, wait a second. Oh, listen to that. Oh, they're playing our song. Yes, sir. Bob Zielinski, do you know the name of that song? Well, come on down. Hey, I heard someone out there say, that's not stupid enough. Well, listen, if that don't do it for you, how about a guy with watermelon attached to his 2 feet, executing the ice skating scene from the movie Flashdance? Ah, you get it right here on Stupid Day at Channel 61. Aw, look at that bozo go, boys and girls. Oh, the magical two-flying watermelon. Woo-hoo-hoo. Hey, look. I still heard someone out there say, that's not stupid enough. Well, how about a guy with a live cat attached to his face doing his bit to do his imitation of Brooke Shields? Oh, look at the brows on that guy going right for the eyes. A better imitation of Brooke I've never seen, though. So there it is, Channel 61, first annual Stupid Day. Knock yourself out, guys. Ha, ha, ha.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
What's the name? Harassing the cycles, my game.
Hey, I'm really kicked off, Ron.
What's that called?
Fire my bug boy, double-decker hamburger sandwich, no fries. How am I gonna make? Get away from my hamburger. I'm gonna enjoy this thing without fries. I ask you, help!
Idea just occurred to me.
What's that, Siggy?
Why don't we have a frog fryer on the show?
No, let go of me.
All right, get in there, frog.
Wait a minute.
If at all possible, please contact me before showing this so I can tell some friends.
Hey, Bob! We're gonna show your film now!
Roll the film, Julia! Ah, here he is, on the old Toro! Okay, kid, off he goes, puts it in gear. There he is, down to his neighbor's driveway. The neighbors really didn't want their, whole thing shoveled. And there he goes after holding his little brother! Oh, my God! Room, right? Okay. What better way to get rid of him? Ma! Dad! Eddie's stuck under the tractor again! I told him! Oh, I think you made your point.
Hey, Vaughn!
Get away from me!
Hey!
What you cool over there? Listen! I know I put you through a lot of paces the last 3 weeks, but we have your biggest fan here tonight, huh?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Froggy's biggest fan, huh?
Yeah, would you like to get together?
Hey, Froggy's biggest fan's here. I'm never too big a star.
Okay, well, come on, little frog, and we'll lay off. There you go, guy.
Wait a second, fool. You're a psycho, I'll tell you. I said lay it on me, not lay me on it. There you go, frog. Your biggest fan, huh?
Now, hang on to this. Boy, that was quick. How about over there? Ah! Yeah. See, it's all done here, all through me. I've got little electrodes on my fingers and go...
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Just a sample of Ron Swede, a.k.a. The Ghoul, who died on Monday in Cleveland at the age of 70. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. We're going to end this week's show with the music that used to end Svengoolie's show back in the day. Take care, everybody.
You may be right, I may be crazy, oh, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. It's too late to fight, it's too late to change.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!